Sorry, I thought that was all. All right, thank you. It's Wednesday, February 27th, 2013. This is the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing. Good afternoon. We will be beginning with a hearing on Senate File 508, Senator Wicklund. This is an optometrist provisions modifications bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. I'm here today to move Senate File 508 for approval and ask the committee for its support. This is a bill which updates Minnesota law to reflect what optometrists currently perform in their scope of practice and allows them to receive the appropriate reimbursements. And before we go further, I have an author's amendment. I'd like to move the author's amendment, if that's possible, Madam Chair.
Senator Wicklund offers the A1 author's amendment to Senate File.
Do we have enough people?
Senate
Do we have
a File quorum? 508.
Do we have a quorum?
Pardon?
Do we have a quorum?
We don't have a quorum, I bet, huh?
Not yet. No, not yet.
Alrighty, we won't offer it quite yet,
okay.
But you can articulate what we're doing here, right?
Okay, thank you. The purpose of the bill is, as I said, to update some language, and the author's amendment simply adds clarification to the scope of practice language at the end of the bill, and also inserts an effective date. This bill is similar to legislation that was offered 2 years ago by Senator Nino and others, and the difference this time is that it has been taken to a key group of stakeholders. They've met a number of times and have come up with language that works for all of the groups involved. These groups include the Minnesota Optometrics Association, the Minnesota Academy of Ophthalmology, the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association, and the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And I have not heard from any other stakeholder groups since the bill has been introduced. So further to explain the bill and the challenge and resolution in the bill, I have with me today Dr. Jonathan Shorn, who is president of the Minnesota Optometrics Association, to offer his testimony.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Shorn, for being with us. Please introduce yourself to the committee and then begin your testifying.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Dr. Jonathan Shorn. I am from Invergrove Heights, Minnesota. I practice and see patients in Lakeville, among other places, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Optometric Association today. We would ask for your support for Senate File number 508. This bill is basically a language change to try and help us to be able to get reimbursement from third-party plans for procedures that we are already doing. We as optometrists are numerous throughout the state. We are located in nearly every county of the state. We do primary eye care. We perform eye exams on a regular basis. We prescribe glasses, contact lenses. But we also see people when they have a red eye or if they get a foreign body in their eye. We deal with people who are suffering with glaucoma and treat them for that condition. We deal with children who are struggling in school to learn because their eyes are not coordinating together. And we work with patients who have suffered traumatic brain injuries. And through those processes, certain procedures that we do require us to not only treat the eye, but the visual system as well. And we understand how the brain processes information. And the challenge that we've run into is that certain third-party insurance company payers have been denying payment because in our language it does not state that we can treat the visual system. Yet this is part of the scope of practice that we have been doing for many years. And so we're basically asking for support of this bill to get the term visual system integrated into the definition of what we as optometrists do. And you'll also see terminology about rehabilitative therapeutic vision care. That, again, goes along with being able to get reimbursed for some of these traumatic brain injury patients who are needing to have the brain process the visual information that's coming in. And so, as Senator Wicklund said, we have met with all of our constituent groups, and we vetted this out with them, and we believe that there's peace in the valley, and so we would ask for the support of this committee to move this bill to the floor for a vote. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. I see another person at the desk. Would you introduce yourselves and present your testimony, please?
I'm Dr. Teresa Theobald. I'm the immediate past president of the Minnesota Optometric Association, and I believe that Dr. Shorn did a wonderful job with his testimony. I have nothing further to add.
But you'll be willing to answer questions.
Yes.
Okay, are there any questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I was reading this, and this might be a misunderstanding of the way licensing works on my part, and I readily admit that, but I'm looking, for example, on line 1.19, employer prescribe ocular exercises. Would this in any way then require somebody who is prescribing those exercises to be licensed as an optometrist, or is this just broadening the definition of an optometry license?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, this does not expand the scope in any way. This basically definition of optometry is basically stating what an optometrist is licensed to do, and it is true that if someone is performing these that is not an optometrist, then they would be subject to a reprimand, I think, from the State Board of Optometry. Now, we do have language in the bill that basically states that as long as this any of these procedures are within the scope of another professional's scope of practice, then this does not take away from them being able to perform that. But it would, of course, prohibit somebody who is not licensed to do that.
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, thank you for the clarification. I did not read that part of the bill, but that answers my concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Shorn and Dr. Theobald. We now have a quorum, so I'm going to ask the committee to vote on the author's amendment for Senate File 508 as recommended by Senator Wicklund. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The amendment passes, and since there's not any further discussion, we can take action on the bill itself. Let's see where it needs to go from here, if anywhere. Okay, so we renew Senator Wicklund's motion to pass Senate File 508 and refer it to the floor, directly to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Bill passes. Thank you, Senator Wicklund. For those of you in the audience, while Senator Rosen moves forward, we've put a little reorganization on the agenda. I forgot to tell you that. Senator Rosen is now going to present both Senate File 402 and Senate File 469.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Rosen.
If it's okay, I would like to start with Senate File 402.
Yes.
469 might take just a little bit more time. Madam Chair? Senate
Please
File 402 is the Adoption Assistance Program modification. Right now, currently the law says does not allow for exceptions based on a disability of either parent or child or children who are seeking daycare assistance through the program. So, Madam Chair, I actually have a constituent that this was brought up to me. They adopted a group of four siblings with significant needs back in 2011 through Department of Human Services. One had partial fetal alcohol syndrome, one had post-traumatic stress disorder, one had reactive attachment disorder, and ADHD was involved in this too. The mother is a working professional. The father is a full-time stay-home father who is disabled. And the children are at a level 3 in their difficulty of care out of 5. But they applied through Waseca County. They were adopted through Brown County, but they applied in Waseca County where they live. But they were denied the daycare reimbursement because their income was too high. But they were told by the county to request the reimbursement through the State Adoption Assistance Subsidy Program. The rules of this program do not allow for child care subsidies if available parent is disabled, only if the adult caregiver is employed or attending school. So again, if you're disabled and you're home attending, taking care of the children, you cannot get the adoption assistant program subsidy, only if you're employed or attending school. So this bill would just make that modification and include the word disabled for somebody who is home in care of children.
Okay, thank you, Senator Rosen. Did you have anyone that wanted to have speak
well,
to the bill?
Unfortunately, Madam Chair, my testifier is working. She's the full-time provider, so she was not able to come. And I do have a very lengthy letter, but I summarized it in my testimony. So it really just comes down to if we wanted to expand the definition of the program to include a disabled parent, full-time parent, or just leave it at employed or full-time student. And I think it's reasonable, Madam Chair. My constituent had problems that perhaps the subsidy should be based on their level of care. Like I said, these children are at a level 3, and she thought there should be more subsidy. And I said, well, I'm not real comfortable with that right yet. Changing the law is very serious. And so I wanted to bring it in front of your committee to see how you feel about including a disabled parent in this definition to receive this subsidy.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. Senator Benson has a question.
And thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen. I think this is probably a good idea. I'm just wondering what the definition of disabled is. There are different degrees of disability, and so a person is more or less capable of caring for a child. So you're very thoughtful in your legislation. Please just let me know what you're thinking as this bill's moving forward.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Benson. I'm not sure if there's a definition on disabled, but I would assume that it would mean that he's unable to work a full-time 48-hour job, a week type of job. So,
Senator Rosen, we could probably provide the definition that's defined in Section 256.481. Actually, it's right here. Disabled means someone who has a physical or mental health emotional impairment, which is substantially limits one or more major life activities, has a record of such an impairment, and is regarded as having such an impairment. Has a record and is regarded. Interesting. So is there anything that you'd like to add to that definition?
No, I apologize. I don't know what his level of disability is, and perhaps I should find that out for you, Madam Chair and Senator Benson, if that is something. I was just looking at he's a diabetic below-the-knee amputee who is retired due to disability and stays home full-time. He's 53 years old.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I can see he clearly, you know, wants to be there with his kids and wants to provide care, but because he's not fully ambulatory, he's going to have a tough time caring for high-needs children. Is this definition of disability tight enough? I'm still learning definitions and how, you know, if you have limits one or more major life activities. I don't know what that means in context. I want to make sure we're aiming for people who really need the help. And so I'm not going to argue with this legislation because I think it's a respectable direction to move in, but I want to see how tightly construed that definition might be. Is there another stop for this bill, Senator Rosen?
No, Madam Chair, I don't believe so. There's
I guess it goes to finance. It'll go to finance.
It would go to finance, yes, mm-hmm. yes.
Okay. Well,
Senator Rosen, I'm just curious. I'm trying to get my head around this, and my question may be just so simple that you'll go, is that really your question? But I'm trying to get an image of this. This is a family that has a special needs child.
Four of them.
They're
siblings, and they're seven. Madam Chair, they're 7, 8, 8, and 10, and they're a sibling group of 4 that they adopted from Brown County.
But the legislation doesn't limit it to somebody that has 4. It could be a special needs child, correct?
Right.
And one of the parents is full-time employed. But one is in the home all the time, but has a disability as according to this definition. So the adoption assistance language would be modified to allow, I guess I'm not clear about what they would be receiving, that that makes the fact that a person has a disability in the home is an issue. I'm trying to understand what the disability issue even is about in its essence. Why are they not allowing this under current law?
All I know at this point, and maybe Ms. White can help me with this, but prior to adoption being finalized, they adopted him in Brown County. They explained the daycare reimbursement process, which was then verified with Waseca County. They submitted an application for daycare assistance through Waseca County, knowing that they would be denied because of their income. Then once they received the denial letter from Waseca, Waseca told them to request reimbursement through the State Adoption Assistance Subsidy Program, and they would pay the daycare.
Okay, I think I'm starting to clear here a little bit. They want daycare. They want support for daycare for the children.
Right.
And because there's someone in the home, that's what throws them out.
Right. And they've been denied of this at both the county and the state level.
Yeah. Because there's someone in the home. And what you're saying, well, if that someone in the home is disabled, they may not be able to do the child daycare. So they ought to be allowed the assistance to have a different kind of solution to the daycare. I think I get it.
And Madam Chair, okay. In the bill on 1.20, child care reimbursements may be made available if available adult caregiver is employed or attending educational or vocational training programs, not if they are disabled.
So, but I do think that the issue was that there's somebody in the home, so that throws them off the eligibility.
That's exactly
but
right.
But the person that's in the home may not, because of their disability, be able to be a reliable child care daycare provider without the other parent there to
right.
supplement that.
That's
I get the understanding. Okay, Senator
Thank
Benson.
Thank you for explaining my bill.
I have to visualize these things or I can't get them. So. Did you have a follow-up question that I interrupted Senator Benson and Senator
Ninau?
Thank you,
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. I think maybe I'm looking for a term of art that would tighten this up, but we'll talk offline. And it's not something I'm fundamentally worried about, but I can see where it might become a problem if somebody only has, and again, I need to look into the definitions of what everything means. Somebody's severely disabled and they've made the decision to adopt high-needs children, I can compassionately understand why they should have assistance, but I need to think about this a little bit more, but I'm not going to raise any objections.
Okay. Senator
Chair,
Rosen.
Madam Chair, to that point, Senator Benson, when you look at the law, the current law, and they're attending educational vocational training program, doesn't say how many hours per week.
Right.
The whole law probably needs a little bit of work.
Yeah.
Employed, how many hours? And so asking for somebody who is disabled, not being able to be employed to receive this this assistance is, I don't think, asking for much, but obviously we probably should take a look at the whole law.
Senator Eaton.
That's a good point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add that having worked in the community quite a bit as a nurse, that there is requirements under the state and county rules to prove your disability either through a doctor's exam or you go through a like at Social Security, they have their own people who do the exam. But so I don't think that would be an issue. I think that having the person with a disability here is clearly has the higher bar to prove than the person going to school or working. I would support your bill.
Thank you. Thank you. So, Madam
Thank
Chair,
you.
Obviously the legislation probably needs a little bit of work, but
yes, I think that the language, though, is around definitions, right, of disability. But in regard to the earlier conversation about looking at this law in general, Senator Rosen, I think, you know, that is something that you might be wanting to do. But I'm noting your language says that on 1.22 that the adult caregiver is employed full time. So in regard to this particular bill, mm-hmm. you are defining how much time is spent outside of the home mm-hmm. to be eligible for the additional assistance.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, if there's not any further discussion, Senator Rosen renews her motion to pass Senate File 402 and referred to the floor.
Finance.
To finance. You'd like that straight to the floor, I bet. Huh? They'd give you trouble there. So, to finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? 402 passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now we have
Senate File 469. Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, I do have an amendment, the A13-0108 amendment, that I'd like to move as an author's amendment to get the bill.
It is in the package for the members of the committee.
And basically this amendment, well, let me, if I could, Madam Chair, I'd like to explain the bill. And you've, and
would you like us to pass the amendment first?
Yes.
But do you want us to just pass the amendments? It's your first hearing, so you can do an author's amendment.
Sure.
Simply add it to the bill.
Okay.
So Senator Rosen moves amendment 13-0108 to Senate File 469. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Would you please proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is a wonderful bill that has been in front of this legislature since 2009, and we've been working on this, and it's been very successful. So my testifiers today will explain about the results of this program, but it's the Chemical Health Navigation Program. And as I said, we passed it in 2009. It back then it authorized the implementation of two chemical dependency pilot projects, one in Washington County and one in the Region 10 counties in southeast Minnesota, which were Dodge, Fillmore, Goodhue, Houston, Mauer, Olmsted, Steele, Wabasha, Waseca, and Winona. And the program proposed basically a new way to work with a subset of individuals that are struggling with chemical health issues, who had multiple episodes of treatment but continue to struggle and place stress on a publicly funded services such as our jails, emergency rooms, our detox, our housing. This population represents the 5% who tends to use a disproportionately high percentage of services and dollars with compromised outcomes as best. But as you'll hear, as I said from our testifiers, how successful the program has been over the past couple of years with the outcomes, the cost savings across the publicly funded system, and that there is no added cost to the Consolidated Treatment Fund. Specific to the legislation today, as the amendment does on the amendment that we just passed, the 1.2, it will basically remove that this is a pilot status. And it will allow the counties the choice to operate the Navigator program beyond the current pilots. It also requires DHS to incorporate this service into the health plan's benefit set, so individuals covered by a plan may have this as a service option. Again, this is strictly optional for the counties to be involved. The counties are committed to providing more effective, comprehensive treatment, which in a number of instances includes procuring stable housing, which is one of the first steps to creating a stable environment for the client that leads to successful treatment and being held accountable for those results. This is, and I will say, is not an effort to get more money from the state. Instead, it's orientated towards providing counties more flexibility in spending the available resources to get better results. It's also an effort to reduce the spillover in terms of expenses to counties, correction system, and public safety at large. And with me, Madam Chair, I have Kelly Harder from Dakota County, who will explain the outcomes that have been very positive from this two-year project. And Madam Chair, also, the department has a few issues. I shouldn't say issues. There will be a discussion about this bill moving forward because they have also an agenda that is really springboards off of this pilot project. So the discussion will be very, very entertaining. Madam Chair, I have Mr. Harder.
Good afternoon. Please introduce yourself to the committee and begin your testifying.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Kelly Harder. In my day job, I'm here Dakota County Community Services Director. Prior to that, I was in Steele County, and that's when actually we started this pilot project. I'm here on behalf of MICA, and the county's represented in that in behalf of my testimony as well. And in fact, we have two folks, one to my right and left here, who will talk about the reality of how impactful this program has been. I want to kind of overarching say we were back here. The irony is I pulled up my testimony back from April of 2009. And the pitch, if you would, to everyone here around the table and on the House side was to let us innovate within the current cost structure and give us the flexibility to meet the needs of a population, as Senator Rosen said, is disproportionately represented in what they cost us and underrepresented in the number impacted. And these are folks who have gone through multiple treatment episodes and continue to struggle having it take hold. Thus, they end up in our detox at $200 to $300 a night. They end up in our jails at $100-plus a day. They end up in emergency rooms on uncompensated care, and on it goes. And so we knew through innovations we had worked with in housing programs and mental health programs how we could be successful. But the consolidated fund, all $120-plus million, says you can do inpatient, outpatient, extended care for the most part, but that was not a tool or an intervention that was working for these folks. So we said, give us the flexibility within the current structure of the consolidated fund, and let's see how we can best meet the needs and see if it actually matters. So hold us accountable, and hold us counties accountable, that if we end up spending beyond the county share, the maintenance of effort within the fund, we'll be 100% responsible for that. And so we know the report on this pilot is due next year. And some might say, boy, this is premature. Well, in the meantime, counties like Dakota, who would like to do this, and we know this works, as you'll hear from the outcomes of the projects today, instead we're paying unnecessary costs because of it, and we're just saying we know this program at the local level works well enough, and that report still should come back to you. DHS will come to you all, and they have been wonderful partners on this, by the way. They will come, and we really appreciate and have partnered with them to look at the whole continuum. This is only one slice and facet for the whole chemical dependency continuum that needs to be looked at, especially with the inclusion of the Accountability Care Act, where now we have folks who will be eligible. We're not in the discussions around are they eligible for GAMC, aren't they, are they, who should pay. They will be, and thus this is also the need on the amendment of probably the most important thing is that this be included in a benefit set to the health plans, because our understanding is the health plans then will be responsible for treatment to these folks, and they too would love to have this tool made available to offer up because it's showing its impact. So with that, Madam Chair and committee members, I'm going to look to testifiers, which they would be actually able to take what all of this comment is about and drop it down on the level. And we are asking that we could take the pilot and hold us accountable. We are not talking about changing the consolidated fund. It doesn't add cost to the consolidated fund. It says let us do the good work we've been doing to meet needs of folks. And when the department has a better tool, then we're glad to hand this one off and do that in lieu of. But in the short run, we're spending unnecessary money on a population we could do otherwise. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Harder. And I appreciated when you were referring to the ACA as the Accountable Care Act.
That's right. For all of us, Madam Chair.
Not the Affordable Care Act. I heard the Accountable Care Act. Okay,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, Mr. Harder brought up a good point that I did not point out on the amendment, and that is line point 16 of the amendment on the managed care, which is amending it to say that the individual eligible for the navigative program is excluded from mandatory enrollment in managed care until these services are included in the health plan benefit set. That was something that was the health plans wanted. We included that. And then we also are taking out the report in subdivision 8 of the bill, 3.33, because that's not necessary at this point. And I hope you remember this bill, Madam Chair. This has been around for a while, and we've been working on this. So we have some good results that I thought perhaps Ms. Kathy Mickelson, who is the social services supervisor from Washington County, could explain.
Ms. Mickelson, introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Mickelson. I am the social services supervisor in Washington.
Could you pull your microphone forward? I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
In Washington County, with oversight of our county chemical health programs. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee In my testimony today, I'm speaking on behalf of Washington County as well as the Minnesota Inter-County Association. Thank you to Senator Rosen for sponsoring Senate File 469. This bill authorizes the Department of Human Services and interested counties the ability to work in partnership to augment the current chemical health delivery system. The services in this bill help individuals to access additional resources and supports in order to improve outcomes such as length of sobriety, employment, and stable housing, which are key factors to recovery. This bill allows statewide implementation of components of the recovery-oriented service of care, which research indicates provide the best opportunity for individuals with chemical dependency to engage in long-term sobriety and recovery. Participation in this program is voluntary. Eligibility requirements are consistent with the current requirements to access the Consolidated Chemical Treatment Fund. With the additional requirements of a minimum of 2 treatment episodes in the 2 years prior to entering the program. We can use an emergency room admission, hospitalization, or detox admission may be substituted for a treatment episode if it resulted from an individual's substance abuse disorder. The services provided under this bill are not currently available in the existing Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund system. The fund can only be used for treatment services provided by licensed Rule 31 programs at this time. This bill would allow all counties to use a portion of the fund more flexibly for a subset of individuals who need additional support services or alternatives to traditional treatment. Washington County and Region 10 in southeastern Minnesota participated in pilot projects authorized by the legislature in 2009 that were models for this bill. These pilots will be ending on June 30th of 2013. The services that the pilot provided included a navigator service, peer and housing supports, a rent subsidy for up to 3 months, supported employment, and independent living skills development. In this model, the navigator role is to identify the services the person needs and assist them to access these services. In the early data on the pilot project indicate an increase in housing stability, employment, and sobriety, as well as a decrease in the use of detoxification services. We also found that many of the individuals participating in the pilot needed access to medical care related to untreated medical and psychiatric conditions. My colleague Heather Gertz will provide more data on outcomes in her testimony. Lastly, the financial aspects of the proposed legislation. There will not be an increase to state expenditures as a result of these changes. The project uses the current funding source in a more flexible manner. The bill allows the commissioners to restructure payment to the participating counties to facilitate the operation. Currently, the consolidated fund is set up to only reimburse for services provided to Rule 31 licensed treatment providers. The bill also allows the commissioner to seek federal waivers and approvals necessary to allow managed care organizations to use the capitated funds from the state to access non-treatment services defined in Subdivision 5. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to participate in the pilot project. We found the flexibility of the pilot was critical in allowing us to assist a group of individuals with severe chemical abuse disorder and multiple life issues to receive the supports necessary to stabilize their life. I'm here today to ask for your support in allowing the state and counties to continue working together to implement the project statewide, which will lead to better use of county and state tax dollars. I stand for any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Nicholson. Ms. Gertz, were you wanting to testify at this time?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Heather Gertz, and I am the clinical director at Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center, and I have directly supervised the Southeast Minnesota CD pilot project for the past 2 years. Thank you to Kathy and for Kelly for such a thorough overview of the services we are providing. I'd also like to thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. In my testimony, I would like to share some of the key outcomes and a few success stories from the pilot project. The Southeast Minnesota CD pilot project has provided intensive services to 81 individuals since the start of the pilot. These individuals had a combined total of 221 detox admissions for the 2 years prior to their participation in the pilot. This number has decreased by more than 50% in the 2 years since the pilot has been implemented. As of December 31st, 2012, the participants have a combined total of only 99 detox admissions since entering the pilot, and more than 25% of these admissions came from one individual as a data outlier. Conversely, more than half of the individuals have had zero detox admissions since entering the pilot. We had one individual who has had 134 lifetime detox admissions prior to participation in the pilot. But since entering the pilot 2 years ago, he has only had two admissions. Another individual has had 11 detox admissions in the 2 years prior to coming into the pilot, but has only had two admissions in the 2 years he has been a member of the pilot. So with the numbers that I have just provided to you, this is a savings of approximately $80,000 a year, or in the 2 years. These individuals have had a total of 275 treatment episodes in the 2 years prior to their participation in the pilot. This number has dramatically decreased upon participation, as the individuals have had a total of only 33 treatment episodes upon entering the program. More significant is that 72% of the individuals have not required any treatment since entering the pilot. Treatment is being classified as inpatient, outpatient, or living in a halfway house. There has also been a significant result regarding housing and employment. 52% of the clients were homeless prior to the pilot. Within the first year, all but one were housed. Only four clients were actively employed when entering the pilot, but after participating in the pilot, 69% of the clients are now actively employed, enrolled in school, or volunteering. I would like to end with a couple stories. The first is of Jane. Jane entered the Navigator program a little over 2 years ago. When she entered the program, she was homeless and on a CD to commitment as a result of being found sleeping under a bridge intoxicated in 0-degree temperatures. The pilot helped her transition from inpatient treatment to a halfway house, then to a sober board and lodge. After about a year, Jane was able to transition into her own apartment, where she still resides and is doing well. This summer, Jane was reunited with her daughter, who she hadn't seen in more than 5 years, due to her chronic chemical use and inability to achieve sobriety. Jane now has daily phone contact with her daughter and has had several face-to-face visits that were facilitated by transportation with the Navigator. Jane is going to school and is close to getting her GED. Jane has plans to get a job working at a detox or something similar because she wants to help others overcome what she has. Jane now has over 2 years of sobriety. The second story is of Susan. Susan has been in the CD pilot project for 24 months. In the 2 years prior to being admitted to the CD pilot program, she had 8 different treatment episodes. She was on probation at the time and she was unemployed. Her drug of choice was crack cocaine, and upon admission to the pilot, the county was both the payee for herself and her son's disability income. Since entering the program, Susan has maintained her sobriety. She has been employed at least part-time through the majority of the past 24 months. She was able to prove that she's capable of managing her money and has regained control of her own income as her payeeship was removed. She is now currently in the process of having the county removed as the payee for her son also. My final story is of Jill. Jill started in our program in July 2011. In the 2 years leading up to Jill's referral to our program, she had 3 treatments, but a total of 11 treatments in her lifetime. Jill was also on probation when she started the program for assaulting a police officer and has several relapses that led to one probation violation and put her in danger of another one. During the course of our program, Jill has accomplished several things. She started an outpatient treatment and a monitored anabuse program. Anabuse is the medication that will cause a volatile reaction if it's mixed with alcohol. Now, 18 months later, she completed her outpatient treatment, continues to take anabuse voluntarily, completed probation in December of 2012, continues to see her therapist and psychiatrist, and has been sober since December 2011, which is 14 months, the longest she has ever achieved. With the support of the navigators and other services Jill has set up, Jill has developed independent skills such as being able to pay her bills on time, make phone calls for appointments, and arrange her appointments. Complete paperwork, all of which she would have put off in the past, are not done as a result of being overwhelmed. I hope these statistics and stories have demonstrated to you the success of this program and the need to continue the work that we have started. Due to the great successes in Washington County and the Southeast Minnesota pilot project, it would be wonderful to offer these services statewide. Thank you for the opportunity to participate in the CD pilot since 2010, and I am here today to ask for your support in allowing the state and counties to continue to work together to implement this project statewide, which will lead to a better use of county and state tax dollars. I stand for questions from the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Kurtz. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on this bill? Anyone from the department? Please approach and introduce yourself.
Madam Chair,
yes,
while the department is coming, we did have the conversation earlier today about the bill. Apparently the department has an agenda that's based or modeled off of this pilot project. However, it's not going to be rolled out until next year.
I'm not from the department, just to be clear.
Oh, you're not from the department. I was going to say,
I'll just ask, is there anybody from the department that's intending
that's
to testify?
Not the person I talked to, Madam Chair, earlier.
It doesn't look, here is someone from the department. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to put that in front of your testimony, but if you'd like to introduce yourself to the committee and testify, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my name is Ellie Skelton. I'm the executive director at Wayside House, and I'm here today representing MARCH, the public policy group. We're the Chemical Health Association in the state of Minnesota. So we applaud this bill in many ways. These services are absolutely needed for the population that we're working with, and we have some concerns about the pilot project. As was mentioned, we do think it's a bit premature because the outcomes of the Navigator project have not been reviewed in detail. The legislature will have the opportunity to review the continuum of care report, that there have been many work groups working on this very issue, looking at how do we expand the continuum of care and make sure that treatment isn't our only option for individuals. And so there have been a lot of work going on already in many work groups, and they're going to be proposing a full continuum of care. And this is premature to look at kind of this smaller subset. We're looking at electronic health records. How does it intersect with the Affordable Care Act? What are the behavioral health care homes going to do? What kind of role would those navigators have? We don't want to create a silo system across the state that won't coordinate well, and chemical health kind of has a history of having a siloed system. So we need to be more integrated with primary care, with emergency rooms, with detox, and there are work groups looking at all of those. Our last point is we just feel like it's premature before you get the chance to look at the full report on March 15th, and I bet Jeff was going to speak to that. And then the other piece is, while it's never the intention of these type of pilot projects to reduce people's access to treatment, we know there's a finite amount of dollars in the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, and we're not asking for any new dollars. And so I think that's just a consideration, is that I know it's a voluntary project, and I know it would be very helpful to have additional services available instead of just treatment, especially for high detox users. And we actually were very much in support of those programs and in the spirit of this bill. We just have some concerns about the timing and the other projects that are currently going on right now. And if we could match all that up, we're willing to work with the author on that, or to have MARCH give input, and also in support of DHS.
Thank you. Would you like to introduce yourself and what you're representing, and yes, begin your testimony?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeffrey Hunsberger, and I am from the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division of Minnesota Department of Human Services. We did speak with the author, Senator Rosen, earlier this afternoon, and explained to her that we are in support of the spirit of the bill, and that we would like to have the opportunity to continue to speak with her and with the county groups further. It's something that they've offered, and we'd like to take them up on it to try to improve the bill and make sure that it better conforms with the direction that we're heading. We do think that navigator services are needed and want to see them added to the services that are available, but we have some concerns that aren't addressed in the bill and would like to have an opportunity to work with that.
Thank you, Mr. Hunsberger. We're just looking at Minnesota statutes passed in 2010, amended in 2011. That's talking about this is, I think, what you were referring to, that the commissioner shall evaluate pilot projects under this section, report the results of the evaluation to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committees by January 15, 2014. That's the work that you're talking about that you're in the process of being engaged in.
That's not the continuum care legislation. That's the pilot project. So there's two. There's that report is the report from the pilot project about their outcomes, the formal report. There's also another report due to the legislature this year that was passed last year regarding recommendations on the continuum of care. So you'll be getting two reports.
And the essence of your testimony is that you support the concept here, but you'd like us to delay it until that time. Senator Rosen, did you want to speak to that, or Mr. Harder?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Mr. Harder wants to speak to that. And whatever we do going forward, and I appreciate the department's initiative on moving forward with this. We have to make sure that we don't move backwards. So if the report's supposed to come out the 15th of March, it's a little late. Apparently it's sitting on the commissioner's desk waiting to be seen. But we have to make sure that we have a continuum of care for these counties that have already invested in this pilot project, perhaps open it up for some other counties that would like to be involved with it. I think there is some concern taking it statewide and then having the department's agenda going statewide also. So there has to be some coordination. I understand that. But Mr. Harder from Dakota County would like to participate in this pilot project. And with that, I will turn the mic.
Thank you, Mr. Harder. And in the process of talking, I thought I heard Senator Rosen mention concerns about the existing program continuing. Did I hear that right, Senator Rosen, that not only are you wanting to expand this, but you want to make sure that that the program that's in place continues to be supported in its current form? Mr. Harder.
Madam Chair and committee members, I think just a brief context will be helpful because, in fact, all of these reports have evolved from the origin of this bill. And I appreciate and agree with March and the department. We've said all along that the challenge here, as always with government, is if it could only just sync up perfectly, wouldn't it just be much easier, whether we're talking about healthcare reform, whether we're talking about education, whatever it might be. But it doesn't work that way. And I appreciate and can concur that it would be ideal that the outcomes, then we can continue programs, but it doesn't work that way. And if we're to not take any action, this program does stop. The capacity technically to keep doing it as counties stops at the end of this state fiscal year. And then what I say to all of you is then how, as counties, are we to reach the individual who's under the bridge, who now is talking to her child every day? How are we able to do that? What we're doing does not add cost. And what we're asking, and so we passed this bill. Last year, counties wanted to run statewide expansion of the pilot because it was working so well. We're asking for another tool than what we currently have, and when a better tool, and we're thinking there will be a better tool because of the comprehensive analysis that's going on across the whole continuum, we'll gladly give this one up because this one isn't perfect by any stretch, but it's working. And the convenience to wait until the reports come, the dime, the cost that you heard on savings, those unnecessary added costs are coming out of local counties' checkbooks and the lives of people who then otherwise aren't receiving this service. So last year we wanted to run the bill, and we agreed with the department to back off coming forward with expansion in lieu of doing a more comprehensive report back to the legislature that you're all going to see in March. Well, our hope was it was going to be done earlier because the intent of that comprehensive review was then to have a recommendation to take this tool out of our left hand, and that we would then have a tool to seamlessly put in our right hand and keep providing navigator services. I think the likelihood, and the department and the counties have been very engaged with March and other providers at the working group, we know nothing is going to start July 1 of this year to replace what we're doing in navigator services. The report lays out a great framework where we want to go in the future, and we will stay committed to collaborate, and we will do that. And if the navigator bill, as we run it, this program, another tool comes along, we will gladly get rid of this one and continue on the standard protocol that needs to happen going forward. But to take no action and wait for just the March report and then the outcomes of this pilot in January of next year means these folks we're helping are not going to be served. So we need the continuation, and there would like to be statewide. I don't think all 87, I know not all 87 counties are going to go in, because we have to operate within our maintenance of effort, and for some counties that's a couple $1,000s. They can't make that work. So I appreciate the spirit of it, but what I'm saying is the burden when we don't have this service is at the local level, and we're just asking a continuation until a better option is available.
Thank you, Mr. Harder. Senator Rosen.
So you understand the conundrum that I'm in, that I did not know about this issue until this morning. And so we've been working on it, and I feel that it's really important to continue this project. I'm willing to work on it. Absolutely, we'll be back next year, hopefully supporting the department's recommendations on a more comprehensive package that deals with this, that has been based off of this pilot project from 09, and because there are some wonderful things that they're going to be using out of this. But I do know there's some counties that want to come in, and so do we just continue on with this pilot project with just what we have right now, or do we allow some of the projects to come in, or do we just say we'll deal with it next year and let the Washington and the Southeast counties default? And I don't think that's a very good recommendation.
Are there questions from our committee? Yeah, I don't see any questions. Amazing. This is the policy committee, so these issues around funding will be pursued further in the finance committee. I'll have questions there about that, but I'll defer those for now. And it's sort of related to getting a clearer understanding, Senator Rosen, of the CDC fund, whether or not these housing, for example, other wraparound services can be dollars can be drawn down to pay for that out of other funding sources other than the CDC, and so that we can have enough money in that funding source. And then what happens if you simply extend the existing pilots versus expanding it, if there's a difference in the fiscal note that would make the – there's not – and that's what I need to understand. You're not talking about more money.
No,
you're not talking
not
about more money.
No.
It's just talking about an expansion of who gets access to the flexibility in how you use that money.
Madam Chair,
Senator Rosen.
Senator Harder – or Mr. Harder has something to say.
Madam Chair, committee members, your question, just really brief. So we have the consolidated fund, and each county has a budgeted amount forecasted, and within it we have a maintenance of effort. This whole navigator has to happen within the county's appropriation of that maintenance of effort. And if there's housing, we, of course, will start and exhaust and move all options into other housing pools, because it's built that it's in our best interest to maximize other funding options first. The last thing we want to do is tap this dollar in our maintenance of effort, because we've agreed for any dollar we spend on Navigator above the maintenance of effort, it's on the county dime 100%. So inherently it's built in, and that's also why it won't affect the consolidated treatment fund as a whole.
Oh, thank you.
Forecast.
Thank you for that.
Would
you say your name again in the microphone for the record?
Ellie Skelton. I just said from the reviser, the first one, 1.2, page 3, delete lines 1 through 9, and that's, which I was actually happy to see that. I believe that doesn't that delete the count? No.
If you go to the section before that, preserve the consolidated fund obligation.
this takes out any conversation about if they're saving, if it's reinvested into the forecast.
Okay.
We don't want to impact the forecast. We don't want to impact the fund adversely.
So that is our concern, is what happens is, especially the counties, the smaller counties, will have an individual that needs treatment and will not want to send them to treatment because they've exhausted their dollars. And so if there's competing issues or competing programs for a finite dollar, I mean, I think it's great to say we're not adding any new dollars, but you can't say we're going to continue to fund treatment and add additional services and nothing's going to change. We still have a finite amount of dollars, and there is pressure on counties of how they spend those dollars, and they'll be making choices around that, and that could end up with people, you know, not being able to access treatment as an unintended consequence.
And we can have a further conversation about that in the Finance Committee.
And Madam Chair, this is, again, optional. This is not mandatory. This is optional for counties to go in.
It sounds like a great option, though, if they've got, depending on their maintenance of effort amounts.
Right.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, Senator Rosen renews her motion to pass 469, Senate File 469 is amended, and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Bill passes. Senator Hayden, are you prepared? Thank you. Senator Hayden on Senate File 246.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. Madam Chair, I move Senate File 246 for consideration to be laid over in the omnibus bill.
Senator Hayden moves Senate File 246 be recommended to pass and referred to state and local government.
Well, yes, ma'am.
And you have an amendment.
I do. And I don't have
this it. Is an author's amendment? We can have it. Do you have an amendment?
I don't have it with me, Madam Chair.
But you have one. Camera. Okay, so yes. We will have this distributed. We'll take action on the amendment before we
thank you,
have
Chair.
You present the bill. Be sure Senator Hayden has one. This is an author's amendment, Senator?
This is an author's amendment. Madam Chair, I move that the A2 amendment be added to the bill to get it in the shape that I'm looking for.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Hayden moves the A2 author's amendment to Senate File 246. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes.
Madam Chair, Senate File 246 is essentially a bill to establish a cultural an Ethnic Communities Leadership Council. The purpose of the council is to advise the Commissioner of Human Service on reducing disparities between racial and ethnic groups within the Department of Human Service and through the services that it provides. A Racial Disparity Reduction Advisory Committee, consisting of representatives from diverse communities and a group of DHS employees appointed by the Assistant Commissioner, has been meeting for the past 3.5 years. And what we are looking to do is, as they have started to deal with these issues of racial disparity, I know that we talk a lot about that, at least since I've been in the legislature. We know that there are really large gaps in healthcare and healthcare access, along with other things such as the achievement gap, which we talk a lot around here in the legislature, and also the opportunity gap or the unemployment rate for African Americans and other communities are very large within our state. So with that, DHS has started to think about this. They put together a group informally to start to address these issues. And through their work, I'm going to have Antonio from the department kind of tell you about their work. But through their work, they have come forward and have talked to me and others to establish a council that will really start to do what I think is a deep dive on this issue. I know that we have talked this year and other years about how can we really start to take the deeper dive on this issue. How can we really start to get ahead of the curve? How can we really start to find out what, as you often say, Madam Chair, what happens before we get to the disease? And Antonio from the department is going to share more information with you, but I do think that this is a good start. We have to do some significant work in this issue. We can't sustain these gaps in health and opportunity and education if our state is going to thrive in the future. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Antonio Wilcoxon from the department.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Ms. Wilcoxon. Would you introduce yourself and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Antonia Wilcoxon. I'm the Director of Community Relations for the Department of Human Services, working on disparities reduction. Thank you, Senator Hayden, for sponsoring this bill, and thank you, committee members. The purpose of this council is to advise the Commissioner of Human Services on reducing disparities between racial and ethnic communities who receive services funded or delivered directly by the department. The bill establishes the duties of the commissioner, the duties of the council, and the duties of council members. As a matter of background, the Department of Human Services is a public agency responsible for helping people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. Responsibility demands that services and outcomes be provided equitably and without regard to race or ethnicity. Research data clearly shows that serious disparities exist between racial and ethnic groups in the services and outcomes funded by the through the Department of Human Services. It is not only a moral imperative to reduce disparities in services and outcomes, but in the public interest to live in a state where all people live in dignity and have the opportunity to achieve their highest potential. Despite the department's best effort thus far to reduce disparities, such disparities still exist. Elected officials, policymakers, and stakeholders agree that more effective strategies could be implemented with advice and input from the groups in which disparities exist. Minnesota has the potential to save lives and dollars by taking steps to achieve the highest level of health for all people, to achieve health equity. This outcome has the greatest likelihood of being achieved if the communities most affected by health disparities are included in the problem-solving process. A study in 2012 from the National Academy for States Health Policy found the following: improvements in health for racial and ethnic minorities and American Indians will increase our state's social and financial capital. In 2010, 30% of Hispanics, 17% of Blacks in Minnesota were uninsured, compared to 7% of the European American population. Insurance status alone will not amend disparities. However, the ability to purchase health insurance will have significant implications for individuals unable to receive care due to the high cost of health care. According to a Kaiser Family Foundation study for 2010 to 2011, the poverty rate in Minnesota is 48% for Blacks, 35% for Hispanics, 28% for others, and 9% for European Americans. In Minnesota, 10% of the residents speak a language other than English in the home. The unemployment rate for Blacks is more than three times that for whites, with 10% of Blacks and 3% of whites out of work for more than 1 year. I thank you again, Madam Chair, and members of this committee for the opportunity to be here and to make this presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Walcox, and thank you for that testimony. Senator Hayden, we have a couple of names here. Do you have some others who you would like to have testify?
No, Madam Chair, this was my only testifier, so.
Okay, thank you. Adil Abdul, are you here? Thank you. Please come forward and make your comments. I'm hoping that you'll be able to focus your comments. We have other work that we want to go forward with, so if you could be succinct, I'd appreciate that. And Sarah Goodsby, is Sarah here as well? Okay. Thank you, Sarah. You can approach and be ready to testify. Thank you very much. Idil, am I saying that correctly?
Idol.
Idol?
Oh. Like American Idol.
Oh, all right. American Idol Abdul. Would you introduce yourself and begin your testimony?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Good afternoon. My name is Idol Abdul, and I usually advocate for autism-related issues, including autism and disparity, which is high. And as you might know, Minnesota enjoys one of the healthiest states in the country, top 10. In fact, it is also, as Antonia said, one of the top bottom for between blacks and whites, and number 49 for educational gap. The only place worse than us is Washington, D.C. I think that is a record for all of us Minnesotans should be ashamed of and should be worried. I think the intent of this legislation is noble. I don't think it will make any significant dent, and I don't want to piss Senator Hayden off, but in terms of health disparity for minorities in Minnesota, and here's why. Number one, in order to decrease disparity, I hope that people write and vote on policies that reflect that. One good example is having the autism bill. And when we're writing legislations, we want to always think about how will this affect the communities of color, the children of color, the minorities, the have-nots. Number two would be to hire minorities in positions of power and influence, such as assistant commissioners, division and department directors, policy advisors, legislative assistants. And DHS, again, I don't want to piss off Commissioner Jessen, but has almost no one in positions of color. And I really feel like because they're the Medicaid agency, I think that the most diplomatic way I can say is that it can improve. If you're going to be the Medicaid agency, and we know that Medicaid is for people who are low income, and we know that people that are low income are disproportionately minorities, it's extremely important for people that look like us to be able to make policies that are going to affect us. And number three would be to provide fair grant opportunities to agencies of color to outreach to minority communities rather than funding mainstream agencies to outreach to us, which mostly do webinars, and most low-income people do not have access to the internet and therefore do not get the information, because that will make an informed patient, makes an empowered patient. I have two more. Number four is to follow the federal class guidelines, which is the culturally and linguistically appropriate services. And I feel as though Minnesota Department of Health and the Department, and again, don't want to piss off Ellinger either, but Minnesota Department of Health and Minnesota Department of Human Services, they get federal funding, yet no one is following at least 4 to 7 guidelines. Which are providing interpreting, culturally responsive services, and at least in the autism world, no one is following that. I hope members of this committee and state agency leaders take the time to really think about long and hard how their policies, their votes, their hiring practices affect and contribute to minority disparities. And for us, minority communities, we must also learn to stop waiting for equality. We must demand it. We must expect it. And we should never settle for less because we are just as American as you and apple pie. And in the words of Steve Jobs, when we see policies that affect us, realize that those who wrote it were no smarter than us. And I just thought of this when I was writing this last night. And if people remember Sandra Fluck and when and the War of Women, and when House Republicans wanted to talk about women's health issues without women, if I can use the same analogy, I think many Democrats like to talk about health issues and minority health issues without minorities. And as a black woman, I could say that might be war on minorities. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Miss, I'm looking, Abdul, I think it is. Idol. I remember Idol.
Yes,
Abdul.
Like Paul Abdul. There you go.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. And I'm sure that Senator Hayden has taken that feedback seriously as a part of this.
Yeah,
process.
Madam Chair, I don't disagree with what Ms. Abdul has said. The legislation that the department is bringing forward is, I think, comes from some significant internal discussions in their own department and some pressure from not only community advocates and activists like Ms. Abdul, but also a lot of members of this legislature who have been asking these questions. I had this conversation kind of briefly in health finance today with Senator Benson, as a matter of fact, about when are we going to start to dig a little deeper, when are we going to start to do something to change the trajectory of these health disparities. So I don't necessarily at all disagree with her testimony. I think this is the way in which we here in the legislature has the ability to start this process to really, really not just talk about it, but to really start to do something about it.
I agree, and I would like to assure you, Ms. Abdul, that there isn't anything that you've said here that's going to create angst or anger at by anyone, because asserting reality and facts is not discouraged here. It's what these hearings are about. And I would like to add with and remind Senator Hayden, remember we were yesterday in health finance, mm-hmm. and there was a report, Ms. Abdul, that was presented from a committee that's working on changing the relationship between the state and the counties and how the counties will be held accountable for achieving certain objectives with benchmarks and measures of real change rather than simply a constant conversation, which is what you're talking about. Admiring the problem is what I call it. And I was really encouraged by the reorganization of how we're thinking about things so that we can capture those markers that tell us whether or not the investments we're making are actually creating the outcome. And if they aren't, doing an analysis of why that is. And you've suggested in your comments that if you design it in a way that the decisions are made through a filter that doesn't understand what the deal is or how to really impact the change, you're going to get the same lousy outcome. So this report yesterday, I think, would have pleased you. It certainly was pleasing for both Senator Hayden and I because we both share a frustration about on both ends that, let's get an idea of what we need to do so that we don't get the problem created in the first place. Right. And at the other end, where we are making investments to sort of turn the tide to make sure that those investments create the outcome intended. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're right on with what everybody else is saying around here. Appreciate your coming to tell us that we're thinking the right way. So thank you very much. And Sarah Goodsby, introduce yourself, where you're coming from, and what your testimony is.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Goodsby de Benavides, and I am the Legislative and Community Relations Manager at the Chicana Latino Affairs Council, which you know as CLAC, and you know that we work to bring the voice of the Latino community to these halls, to the legislator and to the governor, and to the state agencies. And CLAC is part of the informal group that Ms. Wilcoxon has been working with for a long time, and I can give my full support to the importance of formalizing this group through this legislation. It is, as we've heard here, very important to include the voices of all members of our community at the table of the decision makers. And this this Leadership Council is one very positive step in that direction. It is in the state's interest to create this ongoing, formalized council to ensure a stronger commitment from the members who participate, who have broad expertise and experience that they bring to provide very insightful advice to improve the functions of the Department of Health and Human Services. And especially in a department such as Human Services that depends so heavily on serving individual members of our community, it is very important to respect and understand the different ways that these members of the community are being served and how we can improve that service for those who are still experiencing those persisting disparities. So this Leadership Council, I'd just like to end briefly, is a very important step. As we said, it's certainly not the end, but a very important step to begin including that voice, to use conscious and deliberate, to give that attention to the disparities that we all understand are very problematic throughout our state. To ensure that those community members can help identify the practices within the department that can really begin to address those disparities. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Ms. Goodsby. Senator Hayden, didn't you have any final remarks?
No, Madam Chair, I think that we are working hard. I am glad that the department is listening, and I'm glad that they are starting their work and they are starting to kind of put their muscle and their full resources of the department to start to really take a look at this issue. I think that the group that they've assembled, though probably a little large for some members' liking, it does reflect, I think, people, participants who are receiving services, others that are delivering them, legislators, members, staff, and others of DHS to try to come together and really start to deal with this issue about racial disparities, one that I know that we're all very, very concerned of and, frankly, just a little tired of hearing about and really want to do something. So.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Hayden. Admiring the problem and not seeing movement in the benchmarks. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, and we have talked, and I am frustrated at hearing this over and over again. And yet when I pushed Dr. Ellinger on his grant that was supposed to focus on this, they have no metrics. I feel like we keep, again, admiring the problem to death, meeting the problem to death. We need this grant for this group, that grant for another group. Let's meet for two more years and talk about how we're going to solve this problem. And I understand, Senator Hayden, what you're trying to do here, but I am at the point of saying, let's measure something and start cutting funding if people aren't performing. And so we're in a different place, and I sound kind of frustrated, but I would like to propose an amendment to your bill, and I will refer to page 3, line 3.1. And I would like to delete everything after expiration and propose the amendment that the council expires March 15th of 2015.
Where does that go?
And Madam Chair and Senator Hayden,
Senator Benson,
what I believe this does takes people like me and Senator Hayden who agree that we need to move forward and say, you know what, if we're going to form another group, you're not going to sit around and meet and write papers and make recommendations and ask for reports. You're going to start measuring and holding people accountable. And I believe that if they're doing that work, if they're looking at things in the departments and holding programs accountable, that the legislature will come back and say, you know what, you're doing good work and we're seeing a reduction in disparities. But if they're not, if they're just meeting and producing reports that tell us we're still failing, then I don't know that that this is going to be a worthwhile enterprise going forward, and I would I would ask Senator Hayden for his comments.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Senator Benson, I think that's a great idea. I think that we need to start to put those benchmarks, and I think there's none better than to let folks know that they have a space and time in which to do their work, come back to the legislature, let them know what they've done, have some measurables, and if that work is fruitful, then to kind of reallocate the opportunities for them to do it. I think that that is a great idea, and I would consider that a friendly amendment to this bill.
As we talk about that, is there anything in the language here that you would like to see, Senator Hayden, that might raise up this issue that you've talked about, which is you want to see something more than conversation, like a statement that said there that the benchmark that benchmarks will be identified in every annual year report on change or appropriate time for change?
Excuse me, Madam Chair, for talking over you. I think I do. The problem that I'm getting into now is I'd really want to respect the department and their work and have a conversation with them and make sure that they've got 3 years worth of work in it today and kind of develop language that actually gets further to where I think much farther along in terms of the measurement. I just would hesitate to do it, Madam Chair, on the fly. I think that the ideal of putting in a sunset date is great, but to do that on the fly, but this bill does have another stop, and of course we have to all vote on it, and I'd like to
I hope you'll look at that, maybe putting that a little punch.
Absolutely.
We all share this frustration of having the problems described over and over in reports to us without changes in these numbers that have been presented to this committee several times, not just this year.
Absolutely.
Ms. White has a friendly amendment to your amendment,
absolutely,
or to suggest, if you will accept it.
Oh, Madam Chair and members, if the amendment passes that expires the council, I would recommend that we take it out of statute. So on page 1, line 6, delete 256.999. Generally, something in statute goes on. If it's going to expire, it will just be in session law. It will still have the same effect as a law, but it just won't be in the statutes.
Thank you, Ms. White. I would consider
you incorporate that
friendly,
into your
I'll
amendment.
Incorporate it into my oral amendment.
Any further discussion on the amendment, on Senator Benson's amendment to Senate File 246? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes. Senator Hayden renews his motion to pass Senate File number 246 and refer it to state and local government. Any further discussion? As amended. As amended.
Yep. Madam Chair, I know that Ms. Muhammad just has, Ms. Abdul has something that she wants to add.
I'm learning the American political system, so I just wanted to thank you very much for that. And I know this is only Minnesota Department of Human Services, but what Senator Rosen was, was talking about is the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative in the Minnesota Department of Health, which not only did it not make a decrease infant mortality for African American and Latino children, it increased. And that has been 2001 on. So for 10 years, they're getting federal grants and state funding, and they have not made any significant dent. So I commend you for saying, let's cut it off. If you're not doing your job like an employee, we fire you.
Okay, thank you very much. So Senator Hayden renews his motion to pass Senate File number 246 as amended and be referred to state and local government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill passes.
Thank you,
thank you very
Chair,
much,
members,
and thank you to the testifiers.
We will now hear Senate file number 588. Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. Senator Wicklund, I have a delete all amendment and then an author's amendment.
Please proceed.
Do you have the delete all amendment in your packet?
It's being distributed, I believe. It's being distributed.
How should we proceed? Do you want to start with passing the delete all amendment and then I'll offer the author's amendment?
Yes.
So I would move the A1 amendment to Senate file 588.
Okay. All members are receiving the delete all amendment. All those in favor of Senator Sharon's delete all A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Passes.
Thank you, and I'd like to offer the A2 author's amendment to Senate file 588.
The A2 amendment is being distributed. Senator Sharon moves to amend the delete everything amendment with the A2 amendment to Senate file number 588. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? It passes.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Senator Wicklund. As a way of introduction, I don't know that the membership is the same, but this may look like a very familiar discussion item, at least for this committee. I was in front of the committee last year with a bill related to the nurses for criminal background checks, and we had a lengthy discussion about it at that time. It was referred to Judiciary, and I discovered at Judiciary that background check bills were being reviewed and referred over and over again to Judiciary, so they really recommended that we retreat for a year, bring all the boards in, and that have and agencies that have responsibility for licensing professionals, and see if we couldn't come together and find a common language for criminal background checks to be provided to persons when they're applying for their professional license. So that's the history that this may sound familiar to you. We are simply coming back now with the results of the very hard work of all the representatives from all the various licensing boards or groups that do provide licensing for professional groups that are supervised by those boards. And this speaks specifically to a process of doing background checks at the time that the person is seeking to get a license to practice as a professional person. Its goal, of course, is to make certain that the license is extended to those persons who those boards and agencies can assure are safe, particularly because their work tends to put them in relationships with persons who are ill or vulnerable or may have high degrees of dependency. So we want to make certain that those who are in the caregiving position have the highest ethics and standards and do not have a history of demonstrating that they have a pattern of violating others' rights or stealing from other people. So the background check provides us an opportunity to assess that. So with that sort of general discussion, I'd like to introduce you to Shirley Brecken, who's familiar to you, who is here to present the bill, present some more context to the bill, and help you understand what it is that we've done since we appeared before you last year.
Welcome. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Senator Sharon. Senator Sharon is correct. We did come before you last year, as well as the Judiciary Committee, and there were individuals who spoke against the bill, as well as the concern of the Judiciary Committee regarding several bills about criminal background checks. And so we listened to what you said. We went away, and we worked with the individuals who spoke against the bill, And we are before you today with a bill that applies equally to all of the health-related licensing boards. This bill establishes the authority for health licensing boards to require criminal background checks for applicants for licensure. It applies to applicants only, and by that I mean individuals who are newly graduated or those who come from another state and are licensed in another state and are seeking licensure in Minnesota. The one exception to that is that the board can, if an individual licensee is under investigation, require and has cause to believe that that individual has been convicted of a crime, not accused, but convicted of a crime, to require that individual to submit to a criminal background check. The cost of the fingerprinting and the processing by the BCA, or the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation is borne by the applicant. We estimate that cost to be a little under $50. Data is classified as private. That means that the data is available to the subject of the study, but not to the public. The investigation or the processing will be on a case-by-case basis, which is the way the boards do it now. When the boards learn of a criminal conviction, generally speaking, the individual is required to provide the court documents, and then that those court documents or the other information is reviewed by the board, and a determination is made whether or not that individual, based on that criminal conviction, could be of risk of harm to the public. The individual has the opportunity to check the accuracy of the report, and there is a specific time period given to them in order to do that. Finally, the bill does provide planning for the future, because one of the things that we heard last year, too, is what about current licensees? And because the boards don't have experience with the processing of fingerprinting and the FBI reports, we want to be able to implement that for applicants at this time rather than go and deal with the numbers of licensees that we currently have. And the example that I give you is there's about 114,000 licensed nurses in Minnesota, and quite frankly, the boards could not handle that kind of an impact on their work. What I would tell you is that this is a national trend. Currently, there are 37 medical boards across the country that require criminal background checks for as a requirement for licensure, and there are 36 boards of nursing, and the other boards are maybe such as dentistry or social work or psychology are somewhat behind that, but it is a national trend to conduct these kinds of study. And given that brief outline of what is in the bill, I would be very happy to stand for questions, and my colleague Marshall Schrag from the Board of Dentistry is with me today, and I know he'll be happy to answer questions also, as well as several other executive directors of the health licensing boards are here in the audience.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Did you have prepared remarks that you'd like to please introduce yourself?
Thank you, Senator. My name is Marshall Schrag. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, and I'm prepared to walk through the bill with you if you desire, but I think that it's been covered with the introductions that have already been made. So I would just stand for questions and concur with the testimony you've already received.
Senator Sharon, did you have other people that want to testify before we go to
No, we did not. I was just pleased to know that there are representatives here from the other professions that are in the audience showing their support. I didn't know that before I came to the committee hearing.
Okay. Well, then if we would, I'd open it to discussion. Are there members who have questions? No questions? Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Benson.
I always have to, Madam Chair and yes. Senator Sharon. In reading through this, I see the commissioner also oversees hearing instrument dispensers. I can understand when someone has close contact in their home or in a care facility that this might be appropriate, but help me understand how that fits. with a background check.
Thank you. I'm going to have Ms. Breckin answer that, but you've reminded me that I wanted to speak to this amendment. So thank you for the question. During the course, and actually Ms. Breckin can speak to this as well, during the course of the Sunset Commission process in which this was referred for, among other things, for recommendations to us, during which time these issues have been worked out and resolved, the committee had recommended that the Department of Health, that has the oversight responsibility for certain professions, occupational therapists, doulas, audiologists, speech pathologists, are engaged in their own sunset provision process. So what this amendment does says that they will be incorporated into this language, into this requirement for background check, or this process, common process, if their sunset commission does not continue or does not pick up and resolve those issues, which is what they're anticipating will happen. So they're allowed to complete their process through the Sunset Commission, and there may be a different outcome as a result of that. But if that fails to continue or does not address the issue, then they would fall under this common process. So that's what this amendment is about. And then I will have a specific question about hearing instrument dispensaries.
Madam
State your
Chair,
name.
Senator Benson, I appreciate your question because it's what I didn't say is that the sunset review, which resulted in all of the boards being involved in this, required also that the Commissioner of Health, for those health occupations that they regulate, participate in a study and then make recommendations regarding language to the legislature. In the course of those discussions, what we learned about the hearing instrument dispensers and the concerns that the Department of Health has is that hearing aids are very expensive. And generally speaking, it is often the elderly that end up being the client of the hearing instrument dispenser. The concern was, of course, possibility, especially since individuals who have a hearing impairment often are unable to understand the information that's being presented to them. And so there was a great deal of concern about what kind of fraud could be employed. The other thing of concern is the fact that HIDs, or hearing instrument dispensers, are generally not employed. So they aren't in situations where there are others watching their interactions with clients, nor are they subject to the DHS criminal history background studies.
Okay. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I thought this was a little more focused on we needed background checks because of direct client contact, and I'm having a little trouble understanding the independent work nature of hearing instrument dispensers and why they would have to get a background check just because their product is particularly expensive and the elderly are vulnerable. Are we going to require people who sell durable medical equipment to undergo background checks? Because under those two criteria, that would be a reasonable conclusion as a next step. So I'm not trying to pick on that. I viewed this bill through the paradigm of let's protect patients in close contact, and now I'm hearing there's economic fraud issues, financial fraud issues that you're trying to address.
Ms. Birkin?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, I apologize because it's challenging to speak for the Department of Health since they are those that regulate those individuals. What I'm relating to you is the conversation that they brought forward in the study.
Do we have a member of the Department of Health?
Yes.
Would you like to approach and answer the question? Thank you, and please introduce yourself for the committee.
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Matthew Colley, and I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Department of Health. To further expand upon your question, I'll redirect back to the report that was asked of the boards and the Department of Health to look at the background check issue. And in that report, it came out with the recommended language that is in the delete, basically in the delete all amendment. And the Department of Health indicated that we have issues that we should look at regarding background checks for the economic reasons mentioned regarding hearing instrument dispensers. But from the report, the department felt that the language that was brought forward by the health licensing boards wasn't the most appropriate place to deal with the issues that the Department of Health faces that are unique from the board's issues. So since we were up for sunset review this coming year, and that's what prompted the review by the health licensing boards, we felt that we should go through the sunset review process, discuss all of the issues pertaining to the background checks, as well as the rest of the department in that process, and then if it needs to be that we should be doing background checks for those issues or not, that would be resolved through that process and not through this particular bill. So the language as it currently sits, if that process resolves itself and comes to a conclusion, then that would be brought forward in front of the legislature then next year.
Senator Benson?
Thank you. Madam Chair, I think I have an understanding now that they actually will not be required by this bill, but depending on the outcome of the sunset process. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Senator Nelson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, I'm not sure if this was answered. Maybe it was when I had stepped out, but I'm just curious. How have the licensing boards weighed in on this particular proposal?
Thank you, Senator Nelson. They have been meeting, and I can have either of these testifiers tell you about that process. As an outcome of the legislature's last year, I think it was, that I had a bill, and there were other bills from the various licensing boards dealing with background checks, and it was the recommendation of this legislature that we retreat, pull all of those groups together to formulate this language and to resolve the issues of some concerns of various groups that had come to testify. And that was what the work of that work group during the interim, and this is the product that has been developed in relationship to that. So, and testifiers can say more because they were on that work group.
And so more specifically, I want to know, you know, have the boards, are they in favor of this? I know there's a lot of boards, but in general, or are there some that aren't, and what might the issues be if there are any concerns?
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, we went through an extensive process over several months working together with the executive directors of the boards, with the Department of Health, with the Department of Human Services, and with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to work towards a bill that would have language that we could come to agreement on. The executive directors of the health-related boards do meet on a monthly basis, and during the course of those meetings, we've presented this language and voted in favor of that as a group. There are two boards amongst us that have not been in favor of this bill, but are not in opposition to it.
Any other questions?
Then I'd like to renew my motion for Senate File 588 to pass. And it does have a cost associated. It's absorbed by the professions, but it still should be referred for review to finance.
And it
excuse me, to judiciary first. It's a little stop.
To judiciary
that.
First.
Oh, that's where we got caught up last time. So I was sort of hoping to skip that one. Sorry. Tried to slip it by you. So refer to judiciary, excuse me.
So Senator Sharon has moved to, excuse me. The question is on the motion of Senator Sharon that Senate File number 588, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails. And seeing no other business before the committee, the meeting shall adjourn. Thank you.